You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 10th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New York University Professor of History Greg Grandin, on his latest book, Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. Also on the program today, hollowed out, the American middle class now, according to Pew, smaller than those who are either living in poverty or in massive wealth. Meanwhile, Supreme Court of the United States hears oral arguments against affirmative action. Scalia, well, there's some controversy as to just how racist his comments were. But, I mean, honestly, we know.
Is it a surprise to anybody?
No. No. Last night I tweeted that I think Antonin Scalia may be considering a run to be the Donald Trump of the United States of America. Meanwhile, speaking of Trump, two-thirds of likely Republican primary voters agree with Donald Trump's Muslim ban. At one point, folks, at one point, it's just going to be a fact for the political class in this country that the Republican Party is based in nativism, hate, and bigotry. That's just what they're, who they are. And in California, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom floats a gun control ballot initiative, which would deal, at least in part, with ammunition for weapons that kill. All that and more on today's program. Couple of programming notes. First off, ladies and gentlemen, we need your help. Whether you watch this show via YouTube, whether you watch it listen to it on through podcast or live streaming, we need you to send us suggestions for the best of show, ladies and gentlemen. So send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Gmail.com, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Send us your best of suggestions because we need those for a couple of weeks from now. Also on the on our my list of house cleaning to do, I got a message from a buddy of mine who listens to the fun half of the program, often skips the interview, and I'm not going to malign my friend. He's a little bit of a lightweight, but that's okay. I'm not going to point out who he is. You would not know him if I just said his first name, Roger. And I will tell you this, that but through his complaints, he said, you know, one of the things that I now miss about the music, the La Poupée, because, of course, we got rid of that because members, you know, we had people join to basically drive the La Poupée out, is that now I can't tell where to start the show if I want to just listen to the fun half. And so what we've done, what we're going to do starting today in a brilliant idea by New Matt, who, like, now we're, I think that's like your second brilliant idea, because he's now also inserting in codes into the show that if you have the proper podcast app, and we'll get into that later, you can actually jump to specific topics. But we're going to put in the description for members when the fun half of the show starts. So if you're one of those people who just likes to listen to the fun half because it's fun, and maybe you're not interested that day in the intricacies of why medical devices are driving up health insurance rates, I don't understand how that would be the case. It's hard for me to imagine something like that. But if that is the case, then so be it.
If you want to listen to the show like I listen to the show, as an example.
Well, then we would have to put it just at the end. But
I'm in the fun half because I'm speaking.
Oh, I see. So, okay.
See, that was the point of the joke.
I get it. Yeah. We will now include that code in there. And lastly, today on the program, I think Michael will be stepping in for the fun half. No emergency on my part, but I do have to attend something that I cannot avoid. That is a family matter. And so with all that said, let me just remind you, this show exists because of your membership. So if you're not a member, it doesn't exist because of you. I don't know how to put that in another way. I don't want to soft pedal this. You're just there. You just listen. You're just like, you're peeping Tom, like a peeping, not a peeping Tom, like a listening Tom, like an overhearing Tom, or Mary, overhearing Mary. I'm not gonna gender this.
Eavesdropping Earl.
Yes, or an eavesdropping Eve. It is your membership that make this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, still time for you to get justcoffee.coop as a gift for the holidays. And print out your own coupon code for 10%. Draw it up. Have your kid draw it. Give it to them. Use the coupon code majority. You get 10% off. Give them the coupon code majority. They will always get 10% off until we all pass away, I guess, for their coffee. Justcoffee.coop. Co-op, C-O-O-P. And again, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Greg Grandin.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. Killing clowns, a blood money man, shooting foes. Washington bullets again, as every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember the name the days before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad, those Washington bullets again. In the Bay of Pigs in 1961, a banner for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color, is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, the bullet is a spray of lead.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of history from NYU, author of his latest book, is Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, Greg Grandin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start sort of almost a little bit, I don't know if this is quite backwards, but, you know, I think there's a lot of people in our audience who have have a sense of Henry Kissinger that I think, you know, in many respects you debunk here. And I think for a lot of people under, you know, younger than myself, I think Henry Kissinger is just considered this sort of like prominent statesman, wise old man, who really just, you know, if you really just need the answer without all the ideology and this and that, you go to Henry Kissinger. I think there is a huge absence. And you teach history on of Latin America. So, I mean, you would have a better sense of what, you know, 20-year-olds or 18-year-olds, I guess, or somewhere around there, what they know of Henry Kissinger. But let's go over sort of the you know, because you wrote this book in to sort of take, I don't know, to go beyond the trials of Henry Kissinger and the sort of the indictment of Henry Kissinger. But let's just go over that history a little bit so people understand just who Henry Kissinger is in terms of his deeds. So if this is okay with you, I just want to run through sort of like all the places where Henry Kissinger yeah. has really, I mean, in my estimation, you tell me if I'm wrong, caused an incredible amount of human suffering that is ongoing.
Let's do that.
All right, let's just start. I mean, I don't know, which hemisphere do you want to start in?
Well, Southeast Asia is a good place to start. Okay. Vietnam, Cambodia.
Yes, let's do that. I mean, just tell people just, you know, the digest of Henry Kissinger's role and just how much destruction he promulgated or at least oversaw or encouraged.
Yeah. Well, let me just start by saying he's done enormous damage, and I do think he's a war criminal, but I also think that it's exactly that misrecognition that you talk about, the way that people remember him as somehow embodying purpose or gravitas or seriousness of purpose. That is it's a misrecognition, and that the point of looking at Kissinger is actually to not so much to rehearse all of the charges against Kissinger, which I'm glad to do and I will do in a second. It is to link up and understand the current disaster of foreign policy, endless war, permanent surveillance state, drone warfare, counterinsurgency, link that back to Vietnam and Southeast Asia. It's not a blip. There's been an evolution and an expansion and inflation of U.S. militarism from Southeast Asia. And looking at Kissinger's career gives us a sense of the contours of that expansion. Now, Kissinger was Richard Nixon's national security advisor and then his secretary of state, and he survived Watergate, and he went on to hold those both positions under Gerald Ford. The first crime was basically conspiring with Kissinger during the campaign in 68 to derail the peace talks between the Johnson administration and North Vietnam to get Nixon elected. So that's the first crime. Kissinger is involved in prolonging the Vietnam War for five pointless years. By the time the U.S. exited in 73, Southeast Asia, it did so on terms that were on the table in 1968. That's the first thing. So tens of thousands of years.
I mean, just even like saying those words, it's almost impossible to imagine the machinations. And I don't want to get ahead of ourselves in terms of like, you know, what you talk about in terms of Kissingerism and in imperial existentialism and, you know, the reasons why someone would think that's a good idea that doesn't necessarily even have to do with like a strategic thing. Like we've got to extend the war because if we do, then the aliens that are coming from another planet will spare the entire world or something. But go ahead. I don't want to interrupt.
No, and then the second thing was that once they got into office in 69, early 69, once they took office, they had to force North Vietnam back to the bargaining table. So then they began bombing Cambodia illegally and in secret. And they did so for 5 years. And that resulted in 100,000 Cambodian civilians dead, and it so destroyed the country that it made the rise of the Khmer Rouge inevitable, the genocidal Khmer Rouge. So that's the second thing on the docket of indictment of Kissinger. You know, then we can look at Chile, the overthrow of a democracy, and in Chile in 73, Salvador Allende, his support for white supremacy in southern Africa and Angola and Mozambique, and the escalation of civil wars there that resulted in 2 million dead, the support of Pakistan as it committed genocide in what is now Bangladesh in 71, basically because it didn't, you know, Kissinger and Nixon wanted, didn't want to alienate China, and Pakistan was China's friend, telling Suharto in Indonesia that it was give him the green light to invade East Timor, leading to that genocide, hundreds of thousands dead. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on.
Iran, much of what we have today, in Iran, our relationship with Iran was a function of the Shah, of essentially his involvement in the installment of the Shah.
Yeah, it was Kissinger who brokered the turn to the Middle East after being kicked out of Southeast Asia, and using basically cementing in today's current alliance with Saudi Arabia, unbreakable alliance with Saudi Arabia, in which we buy expensive gas and they buy U.S. weapons, and then they deposit the rest in U.S. banks. We had that deal with Iran too, but then that led to the revolution. So a lot of the catastrophe in the Middle East and the militarization of the Persian Gulf could be traced back to Kissinger. Again, you know, this isn't what the book Kissinger's Shadow
right,
meant
yes.
to be, a kind of devil's theory of war where I blame everything on Kissinger, but I think Kissinger lights up that history like no other.
Yes,
like
and we're going to have plenty of time to go into that. I just want to make people make sure that people have the foundation that I think, you know, someone, you know, my age and older might just sort of assume that knowledge is there. And, you know, for a long time we didn't. You know, we didn't know this stuff. I think, like, you know, and I would argue that now a vast majority of people, and I want to get to the whole part that you talk about, like, you know, with Samantha Power at, you know, the Red Sox game, because that to me, you know, but let's save that for the end, because on some level that to me is also fascinating. The idea that, you know, your book, I think, really really delves into that myth around him and what the real implications were, and it was inspired by also by that dynamic in some respects, and I want to get to that, but we should also just add too that I know that, you know, Israel Palestine, that conflict, he in many ways, you know, sort of helped cement that conflict, I guess, or at least in terms of foreign policy. That does that, you know, I don't know where to put that on the scale of his
yeah.
You know, that may be just really bad policy.
Well, it's all part and parcel of you know, turning the Middle East into this impasse. I mean, that's just, you know, one part of the story. Him, you know, he locked in the impasse of Israel and Palestine. He was playing both sides off of the other, playing oil-producing Arab states off of Israel, playing Israel off of them, and basically created not a framework for negotiation of the solution, but a kind of, you know, a framework to lock in the crisis permanently.
All right. So let's move on to Kissingerism, which I think you would argue we are still very much living under and have always, I mean, or at least not always, but I mean, since his time. Let's start with this idea of imperial existentialism, which you, and it seems that your reading of Kissinger's thesis was university thesis was sort of the genesis of the book that you ultimately wrote.
Wrote a 400 page undergraduate thesis at Harvard on, you know, wasn't particularly concerned with foreign policy exactly. It was a meditation on European philosophers. And what was interesting about that is that Kissinger's often misrecognized as a realist. And within the spectrum of U.S. foreign policy, a realist is somebody who believes the U.S. should use its power to promote its interests and not be caught up in kind of idealistic motives of supporting democracy or defending human rights. I think that's a misrecognition of Kissinger. And you know, and the way Kissinger is talked about by critics and admirers alike is that he is, you know, he represents this realist tradition. He's serious. He believes that we have to have a sense of our own power and we need to know our limits. And, you know, I think that misrecognizes how deeply, and they also say that realism is somehow a jaw to American idealism, this kind of, you know, that America is an idealist nation, that, you know, and it believes in itself, American exceptionalism. I think Kissinger is a quintessential American exceptional. He believes in, he was very much influenced by a subjectivist strand of German romanticism, German philosophy. We might associate it commonly with Nietzsche. Kissinger gets it from another kind of subjectivist, a will to power, irrationalist, Oswald Spengler, who was writing in the early 20th century. Kissinger doesn't believe that he might believe reality exists, but he believes that we don't have access to it other than the meaning that we as subjective individuals assign to it. And the only way we draw meaning from that is through action. So this becomes a kind of merry-go-round. We have to act in order to create our understanding of reality. We have to project our power to get a sense of our own power. This is a circularity that I think is deep in American militarism. This sense that, you know, we've become over-rationalized, we've become over-bureaucratized, we, you know, the accountants and the economists and the bureaucrats have taken over, and we've got to restore a sense of a warrior spirit, a poetic spirit. This is neoconservatism. This is the kind of sense that America has to act in the world. If you remember in 2003, 2004, there was that quote by a Bush staffer that many now believe is Karl Rove, that, you know, America is an empire now. When we act, you know, we create our own reality. Right. A lot of people took that as the height of, you know, neoconservative arrogance. I mean, Kissinger said the same thing 50 years ago. Kissinger, you know, this is,
I got the quote right here. There are two kinds of realists, those who manipulate the facts and those who create them. The West requires nothing so much as men able to create their own reality. So I just want to, like, you know, like, slow walk through this, because this is so important. Because, you know, when we talk about realism and realpolitik, the idea is that there are certain immutable facts that exist. This country wants that resource. This country also wants that same resource. And how do we negotiate that situation so that we get that resource? Whatever our agenda is, these things are as they are there. And what you're arguing is that Kissinger, although he is like attributed with that, right? That it would recognize, like, oh, we have limitations. We can't go into that situation. We just simply can't get that resource, or we can't get that victory. We've got to go to a lesser position. We'll take the half a sandwich or three quarters a sandwich or whatever it is. You're arguing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Kissinger actually sees it like, no, it's not like that. We need to do something, wave our arms in a certain direction, see what the ripples are and impact the situation, and then it will shake up, and then we go in.
We have
and get
to create order from chaos, you know, and yes, Kissinger, you know, the defeat in Vietnam did impose a certain degree of an understanding of limits and interdependence, but in general, I mean, look at Vietnam and Cambodia. I mean, it was the height of idealism. You know, if realism is that you accept the world as it is, Kissinger and Nixon bombed Cambodia and North Vietnam for 5 years. They bombed it, you know, back to the Stone Age because they wanted to live in a world where American power could force a third-rate peasant country to bend to American will. And it didn't. That's the height of idealism, right? Trying to create the world you think you ought to live in. And it was a complete failure. And after Vietnam, Kissinger was, you know, very, very, you know, his advice to one president after another was, you have to take bold action to reestablish a sense of credibility. A sense of credibility among our adversaries, but a sense of our own purpose among ourselves. And Kissinger was, you know, he was a big proponent of the first Gulf War. And again, not because he thought there were any objective interests. I mean, you know, he said it doesn't really matter who pumps the gas, whether it's the sheiks or whether it's the, you know, whether it's the Baathists. You know, what matters is that we you know, we order the Middle East in a way that conforms to our understanding of our own purpose. And he was a big supporter of the first Gulf War. He was a big supporter of the second Gulf War. And even after everything started to go south in 2003, 2004, after Abu Ghraib, after Fallujah, after the whole thing, Kissinger was urging Bush to stay the course. And again, it had more to do with our creating, firming up our own domestic will than it had to do with any objective interests in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The demonstrative effects produce of one's act of will are more important, essentially, than the impact on victims. In other words, it sounds to me like what's important here is not so much where the bombs land, just that we fire them off.
Yeah. And, like, obviously this is a strand within American history that has deep roots. But I do think that the 1960s represented a qualitative turning point. The polarization in American society, which Kissinger didn't create, but Cambodia and Vietnam helped accelerate, and Watergate helped accelerate and aggravated, created the conditions in which foreign policy became more important as a domestic issue than any objective interest. So obviously we want to open markets, and we want to get access to oil and other resources and whatnot. But what really matters, though, was the way in which foreign policy became completely subordinated to politicians who were leveraging that polarization at home for domestic benefit. And that, that has deep roots. Every politician going back to George Washington, I'm sure, used foreign policy for domestic posturing. But something changes in the 60s, and it's Nixon and Kissinger that preside over that change and take advantage of that change.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because this is I think, in the context of what America does in its foreign policy, I'm not sure that there's a radical break with Kissinger, although the means, it sort of in some way seems to be. But that element of how much foreign policy is implicated by domestic sort of agendas, political agendas, does it go from 49%, 51% to 51%, 49% at that point?
I think it's always hard to calculate the exact percentage, but, the need to look tough. I mean, look, just step back and look at the disaster of today, right? I mean, ISIS, nobody knows what to, we didn't have to go into the Middle East to secure oil in 2003 or 1991, or the Persian Gulf. There's no rational explanation for the U.S.'s foreign policy in the Persian Gulf since the 1990s. Clinton supported regime change because he wanted to look tough, and he was trying to, move the Democratic Party to the right. So going back to Nixon and Kissinger, the bombing of Cambodia and the bombing of Laos and the bombing of North Vietnam had as much to do with trying to win over militarists and the rising new right. Nixon would dispatch Kissinger out to speak to movement conservatives out in California, Bob Hope and Ronald Reagan, and say, look, how can you say there's no difference between Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon? We wouldn't have had Cambodia. We wouldn't have had Laos, meaning the invasion of those two countries. So in other words, it was just really about building a domestic constituency on using war and militarism for that.
How much
support
of that
for white supremacy in Southern Africa had everything to do with the Nixon Southern strategy,
right,
winning over white racists in the South. That's why we supported white supremacy in Southern Africa.
Is it your sense too that when we talk about attacking Vietnam? Does that also play into that sort of, that sort of Southern strategy on some level? Because it's not like we're talking about invading, we're not going to invade Eastern Europe. We're not going to white people.
I think the destruction of Vietnam was blood tribute to a rising new right. I think that Nixon and Kissinger wanted to look tough remember George Wallace and Curtis LeMay got a big chunk of the vote in 68. They were terrified that the right was going to bolt again from the Republican Party in 72. So they wanted to make sure that they built their majority, and they got it. And foreign policy was subordinate. It was constantly about looking tough, and using war and militarism for that the domestic. And you know, you could go back earlier. I mean, you could make the argument that LBJ went into Vietnam as a trade-off for trying to get his Great Society program at home. But I do think, you know, I think the deepening polarization that Vietnam causes and that war, and, you know, leads to this the further subordination, qualitative shift in the subordination of foreign policy to domestic interests.
I want to tease out a little bit more about how we go from Kissinger to neoconservatives, and we don't see that much of a break, but rather in some way, you know, there's a certain undergirding of Kissingerism in there. But before we get to that, let's just talk a little bit about, because what you call the post-consensus unraveling, particularly on how it deals with the modern surveillance state. And we last week, I think it was, we had Charlie Savage on this program. We've talked to him a couple of times about this, the continuum and the comparing and contrasting sort of the Bush administration surveillance policies, national security policies, with the Obama administration, particularly as it comes to sort of what we consider sort of the modern surveillance state, maybe homeland security, expanded. But tell us, like, what elements, and particularly with the imperial presidency, How much of what we see today in that realm is sort of a legacy of Kissinger's time with Nixon, and then, I guess, is sort of like, I don't know, seemingly endless sort of corralling, you know, in terms of the advice that he provides since then?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, you know, I was careful in the book not to draw a direct causal relationship between Kissinger and what comes later. I think he lays the groundwork. I think you can look at Southern Africa and all of the illegal covert activities that he was doing in Angola and Mozambique and draw a link to Iran-Contra, you know, that comes in the 1980s. I think
this is the idea of, like, farming out stuff, mercenaries,
yeah, using third party,
sort of like off-the-books,
you know,
wars.
So Kissinger comes to power, you know, there's the old Cold War national security state coming out of World War II that's based on elite consensus, bipartisanship, you know, if not public support, then at least public acquiescence. You know, that collapses with Vietnam. That collapses pretty much. That collapse corresponds to Kissinger's tenure. Again, Kissinger doesn't cause the collapse. He's not the one that drives us into Vietnam, although it must be said, in the 50s, as the defense intellectual, Kissinger is urging the U.S. to fight wars like Vietnam, so he does bear some intellectual responsibility. But, you know, he's not really responsible for Vietnam. But he presides over the collapse of that old national security state based on consensus, acquiescence, elite planning, what I try to look at in the book is the way Kissinger helps reestablish an imperial presidency on a new post-Vietnam footing based on ever more spectacular displays of power. You know, Kissinger is constantly urging, you know, urged Gerald Ford to, you know, to think big and go in big, and, you know, but spectacular displays of power, ever more covert operations to bypass what had now become a very meddlesome Congress and a meddlesome press corps, right, figuring, you know, obviously the U.S. was involved in covert activities. I mean, you just read the David Talbot book on the Dulles brothers and what they were doing in Guatemala in the 50s, or Laos in the early 60s. But I do think it's a qualitative difference that happens when that covert activity is done to avoid congressional oversight, you know, and, you know, or journalistic oversight, you know, a way of bypassing what had become a skeptical public, you know, and a war-weary public. And then
how much involvement did Kissinger have in that sort of like a Dulles regime of
well, he didn't really. I mean, I think that they in just typological comparison, I think the Dulles represented the old Eastern WASP establishment. You know, they were the old national security state, the backroom Georgetown, you know, the pipes and the tweed. Kissinger represents a kind of Arabiste you know, agent of the post-war meritocracy. He's a refugee. He uses the national security state not as a presumed executor of it, like the Dulles brothers, but he uses the national security state as career advancing, as a way of working up the, you know, the meritocratic ladder, you know, and that's a difference. I think Kissinger represents a kind of democratization in some ways, for lack of a better word, of the national security state, in which people saw their personal advancement and U.S. militarism as going hand in hand. I think it's a little different than the Dulles brothers.
That is, that's a really creepy idea. It's a little bit sad. I mean, you know, but I mean, I guess to a certain extent, right? That goes to how you would use foreign policy in a way where its, you know, chief aims may be even more about domestic than actual foreign policy outcomes, right?
Because yeah, exactly. And it also explains his close relationship with Nixon, because he is an outsider, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has one foot in the old Eastern establishment. I mean, he manages to get into Harvard under the GI. I mean, you know, again, the way World War II and the Cold War democratizes national security, he gets into the GI Bill, gets him into Harvard. Before that, he had been in military intelligence during World War II. You know, he didn't have any contacts. He used his intelligence to kind of work his way up and receive a commendation in World War II, in military intelligence. And he's in world. Then he goes to Harvard. He makes contacts there with a lot of the old Cold Warriors.
Right.
In the professorate, but he's Jewish and he's a refugee and he's an outsider, and so Nixon, even though despite his anti-Semitism, bonds with Kissinger. So Kissinger could both let him know what the WASPs are thinking, because Nixon hates the Eastern establishment, and he could, and Kissinger could also criticize the WASP establishment as an outsider.
Right. He always did seem to be able to play Nixon quite a bit.
But
let's move to sort of this idea that, okay, so he provided some of that, the foundations. How much is Nixon like a but for, I mean, Nixon, excuse me, Kissinger, a but for figure? I mean, I know you do not make the argument in the book that none of this would have happened but for Kissinger. But I mean, it's, you know, like I was just sitting here, we were talking about Kissinger before. I was like, you know, it's a hard calculation to make, but there's hundreds of thousands of people whose lives were either lost or sort of like irrecoverably not destroyed, but like, you know, burdened even to this day because of this guy. And there's not many people in the history of the world that you can say that about. You know, part of it's technology, right? Like, we didn't have the ability to kill hundreds of thousands of people, 500 years ago. I mean, this is pretty stunning stuff. Like, but
yeah.
How?
I mean, I think, you know, the way that you resolve that problem, because you don't want to, you know, blame, you know, you don't want to be a devil's theory of war or militarism and blame everything on Kissinger.
Right.
But history and structure do produce singular individuals that somehow are able to seize on the larger contradictions and then, you know, advance them. And I think, I think American history is filled with these people. And you don't have to have a great man theory of history to know that Andrew Jackson was key in settler genocide. that Franklin Roosevelt was key in the creation of a welfare state in World War II. Like, I mean, you don't have to. It's not an either or thing. And
right.
I think Kissinger was both singular and he embodied the zeitgeist, the contradictions of the moment that he, and he was able to, you know, to press them forward both for his own advantage and for historical consequence.
And there's a sort of a not so virtuous cycle too involved here, because he both helped along, was the sort of the guy who carried the torch, if you will, at the very least, of certain strains of American exceptionalism and sort of this, you know, his version of that's, you know, second type of realism, like where we can sort of create a reality to a certain extent. He carries that torch, but then also he justifies his torch carrying by what existed after it, right? He's like, I carried that torch, but, you know, the guy after me also carried it, which is proof that, you know, I should have carried it.
Yeah. And he goes on, I mean, you know, and we talked about his in-office career, but, I mean, he goes on to found one of the most influential consultancies in the world. I mean, it basically brokers the post-Cold War privatization of the global economy. You know, I mean, don't forget he was appointed by George W. Bush to be the, you know, chair of the 9/11 commission, but he had to step down because he wouldn't reveal his client list because he was deeply involved with Saudi Arabia, you know. And he's, again, the fusion of self and society in Kissinger is profound in the sense that, you know, the advancement of militarism advanced his career. I mean, he is, you know, has lived a long and prosperous and eventful life, and he's going to die probably very happy, you know?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, too, is you start your book off as sort of writing his obit. And let's talk a little bit about that aspect of it, because I've been fascinated by how he is revered. I mean, you talk about, you know, seeing that image of Samantha Power and him at a Red Sox game. I think it was like on ESPN or something like that. And, you know, and we see how he is almost in all quarters, you know, celebrated as this wise old man. And it's, Hillary Clinton has praised the guy, and which is not, I shouldn't say that with like some measure of shock per se, but but it is fascinating, as if like you know, if you want to get into the club in some way, you know, don't diss Henry Kissinger.
No.
And I'm not I'm talking about like not just even like the foreign policy club. I mean, it seems like if you want to be part of the American elite, you know, I had mentioned before we got on the phone call that, you know, and I think I've mentioned on this program that I used to work professionally in entertainment with Kissinger's son. And I remember hearing stories of like, and he was in Hollywood, and I remember hearing stories of like, you know, I went out to dinner with Jim Carrey and my dad. You know, just sort of like, what? Wait, what? Like, this is, you know, crazy stuff. And Colbert does bits with him. And Colbert is a very smart guy. He certainly knows all the history that you probably teach about Kissinger's involvement in Latin America.
Colbert turns him into some kind of avuncular, you know, elder statesman, and Clinton. I mean, I think part of it is rich. I mean, you know, Kissinger, you know, Kissinger hatred has been generational. I mean, I think the people came out of Vietnam and Cambodia and watching Laos and Cambodia or Latin America in the 70s have a visceral hatred for Kissinger. I think that reached its kind of apex with Christopher Hitchens' book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, which, you know, indicted him for war crimes. And since then, there's been a rehabilitation of Kissinger. In some ways, though, the rehabilitation started well before Hitchens. It was Bill Clinton who embraced. It was the first Democrat who embraced Kissinger, and that was because Kissinger played a key role in getting NAFTA negotiated under George H.W. Bush, and then getting NAFTA ratified by Congress under Clinton. Kissinger became an advisor to Clinton. So Hillary Clinton's closeness with Henry Kissinger is understandable in those terms. But I also think at this point it's a little ritualistic. The worse things get, in the sense where nobody knows what to do in terms of foreign policy, right? The complete disaster and impasse in the Middle East. Kissinger, there's a nostalgia for a sense of gravitas, a sense of kind of purpose that Kissinger, even though my whole point of a book is that he said he never actually embodied, he represents. So Samantha Power, who rose up writing about genocides that Kissinger helped perpetuate, you know, goes to a Red Sox game, Yankees game with him, and they banter as if there's some kind of geopolitical Spencer and, you know, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, you know, and it's really disgusting.
Right.
You know, Clinton calls Kissinger her friend and says that she takes advice from him. You know, it is, I think it's affect. I think there's a ritual, you know, because there are no adults in the room anywhere. And so Kissinger somehow embodies that earlier moment.
I mean, how did that, I don't understand like how that happens. I mean, it's funny because I have an old friend who titled his book after a near exchange with Kissinger in a green room in CNN, entitled "I Never Shake Hands with a War Criminal," where he was asked, like, "Do you want to meet Mr. Kissinger?" He's like, "No, I don't shake hands with a war criminal." But on some level, it's like, okay, well then you're out, you're on the outs. It's sort of fascinating because in some ways, like what Kissinger. His theory in terms of foreign policy seems to have, like, he's applied to his own sort of celebrity in some way.
Yeah.
Like, you just keep going forward and maintain. There was one interview that he had where somebody recently brought up, I think I saw you reference this somewhere, where somebody brought up Cambodia. He's like, that was 50 years ago.
Yeah,
really? Are you going to talk? Like, you know, there are people, first of all, you count in your book on how ordinances still go off on a regular basis. I mean, thousands of people die because
Cambodia.
Of it. So, you know, it's all too real for literally tens of thousands of people who are directly impacted, but I mean, who could see, you know, the whole trajectory of that, of that part of the world has been changed. And yet he's just sort of like, come with something more recent. Like, you know, that who picked up the check at Sardi's or whatever it is. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know. And part of that is the hollow. I mean, I think a larger argument is that war, unending war and militarism has hollowed out, you know, the substance of this country so that, you know, that's what we have. You know, you can't actually talk about, you know, the content of his policies. It all just becomes the performance of his policies. But, I mean, that's one of the things to go back to the question of post-war meritocracy. Kissinger was very good at sussing out the press, at basically selling himself, being all things to all people, right? He could be, you know, he could be Nelson Rockefeller's centrist advisor. He could be Richard Nixon's, you know, anti-establishment advisor. He could be everything.
Do you think, I mean, lastly, just to tie this out, and it's a little bit outside your portfolio perhaps, but do you think there's an element in Trump in that? I mean, that notion of like, I'm just going to lob these bombs and it doesn't really matter where they land. It's just that people are going to see me lobbing bombs.
I think there is. Obviously, there's ways in which you can, you know, other people, defenders of Kissinger would say it was the opposite. Defenders of Kissinger would say that, you know, Trump, there's no substance, that it's all, you know, but I think there is that hollowing out of militarism, that endless churn of, you know, projecting power in order to get a sense of our purpose, and our sense of our purpose is the projection of power. I think that could be traced back. It doesn't trace back to Kissinger. As I said, it traces back longer, but Kissinger kind of embodies that.
There's a line you can draw from Kissinger to basically, I think it was telling Ford, we just got to get vicious or something like that. And Trump just going like, nobody's more militaristic than I am.
Yeah, right? I know. Okay.
Unbelievable. Well, Greg Grandin, thank you so much. The book is Kissinger's Shadow. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much. It was a great conversation. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. Fascinating. I mean, Kissinger has always been a fascinating figure, that both in terms of, and I think, you know, I hope that point isn't lost on people, that sort of understanding the structural reasons why a guy like that has the impact he has, and how, and see where it is today. And then also that other, that sort of almost like sociological element of like, Michael was talking about how he was on HuffPost Live the other day.
Right.
And some guy was like, things are so complicated. I hope Henry Kissinger's had a lot of coffee today or something. Like, what?
He's just the stand-in.
Stand in for, you know,
for
I guess, daddy who comes
propriety
in.
Propriety, right. And it's like,
Somebody wake up, Dad. Right. We got a real problem.
Yeah.
Oh, well, he's out actually beating the dog right now. And
Dad actually set the fire that we're trying to put out.
Right. After he's done poisoning the neighbor's cat and beating our dog, he'll be in to give us the advice on what we should do.
Very complicated.
Very strange that whole thing. It's just that, and it's been with me for years and years. And I mean, I think to a certain extent, because, you know, I don't know. I ended up having one of those professors in college who told us about Allende, and I was
that's how I know it.
Entree into that, and then, you know, 5 years later. I don't know, ten years later, his son is giving me my first opportunity to direct and produce my own show.
So there is
Beat
some...
Cops.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, he's in it.
He's in Beat Cops?
He's in. That's hilarious. And he's a very nice guy.
I'm sure he is.
A very nice guy. And
I know people who personally have interacted with Henry Kissinger and say he is also a very nice guy.
Right. I mean, he was sort of like famously... charming,
very
kind of
jovial, easygoing, has good sense of humor.
And he's 92 years old. I mean, there's no, it really just, you know, it throws all of it out the window, doesn't it? Like, you feel like, I'm not going to go pick up that piece of litter on the ground. Like, why? It's not going to happen. You know, like it just sort of the idea that there is any type of, you know,
like
karma,
like
in
Kissinger's
the world,
like sitting in the back of a limo next to like a dead body, looking at like, oh, look at the effort. It's very nice of you to pick up that banana peel. Let's go to a meeting of the private board.
I mean,
now,
honestly, like, you know, is karma gonna get me? You know, I don't know.
It's not really how karma works. I got it. If I could geek out with you on it for a second.
All right. Go ahead. Well, how does it suppose?
Well, if
in the next life.
It's more subtle. It's more like the idea would be like maybe there's all sorts of things in Henry Kissinger's own inner psyche that could be affecting him in ways that are imperceptible to you or I that could be a consequence of the things he's done. Also,
you know what?
What's
great about
that? Doesn't account for is he could be a sociopath, and it just doesn't.
Or he could have like really bad athlete's foot. Like that's like the one thing. But, you know, here's the thing about theories like that.
So, you're going to bomb Laos? Well, in left foot too, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the thing about, like, that thing where it's imperceptible to us.
Yes.
I think theories that are founded on that are just really to make you feel better.
No, it's not about,
like, he's suffering.
It's not about...
He's definitely suffering.
No, it's not about, though. It's not about making you feel better with other people suffering. It's just that I understand what you're saying.
But that's just to keep you in line,
it's
dude.
Not exactly a bank. No,
like,
the bank...
Michael, if you go on to extend a war for 5 years, which causes the death of hundreds of thousands of people and implicates the lives of many, many more, never mind, you know, both U.S. military personnel, civilians,
right.
I mean, just on and on. believe me, you're gonna have some real psychological problems.
Well,
later
the other thing it gets into is
it's not gonna be perceptible to me. But we're gonna pick it up around the office.
Clearly does not think that anything he's done is in any way fundamentally problematic. So that's a whole other aspect as far as that goes. And then there's collective karma and collectively reward that behavior in our society, which is the whole point of that interview. So he thinks he did right, and he's been rewarded by winning according to the games we've set up for ourselves.
Yeah, so in just sense. About every sense. I mean, he seems, as far as I can tell, to have a decent relationship, at least some members of his family.
I feel like...
The guy's going around, you know, having parties put on by, you know, whoever it is, you know, whatever.
Samantha Power thing is really strange. I mean, did you ever read her book?
Yeah.
It's not just that... She talks about situations he was key to creating.
Foundational.
She names him.
Right.
It is not like, and it's, I mean, people could write a
now,
book
I will
or say
this.
Like, oh.
Yankees, Red Sox.
Yeah, right.
You know, if you get good seats to that, I can see how that's, you know, a dilemma. Do I go with this guy who I attributed sort of the deaths of tens of thousands, 100,000 people? Or, you know, free seats at the Yankees.
The other thing too is you feel like I remember with that Colbert bit that he was in, and I happened to be I watched that with some other people, and you feel like that guy. If you're like, hey guys, actually I know we're all enjoying this, but you know it's kind of not cool that he just gave a war criminal a nice cameo there. You don't want to be that guy, even in such a micro, silly, irrelevant level as like a couple of friends watching a comedy bit,
right?
And then, you know, amplify that out to all of these interactions. And just how you said, Barry Crimmins, like, oh, he's so weird that he's like, I'd prefer to not socialize with this guy that has maybe the blood of literally millions on his hands. Yeah, I'm not into that. And the response is like, oh, all right. Well,
that guy's a drag. In the later days of Air America, when it was run by the most sort of like, not right-wing people, but it's sort of like, you know, I'll vote for Romney, that type of guy. You know, they're like, eh. That's when you got the most of that sort of eye-rolling, you know, like where they would come to me and go like, we got a spot for you to read, you know, Gold or something. And I go, you know, I don't really feel comfortable with that. And they're just like, oh, why? Well, I mean, I don't think that's a sound, you know, like I don't want to be in a position of lending my voice to that. Like, I'm not going to protest if other people do it, but I just don't feel comfortable. Ugh. What about, like, and then, you know, I had that guy when I did that 3 to 6 show, that guy, Ron Hartenbaum, and I only mention his name because I think he's just not a good person.
I can attest to that. I've heard this off air as well.
But he at one point wanted me to, it was Dinesh D'Souza he wanted me to promote his book.
What?
The like, you know, like Obama's America or whatever it was. And I'm like, wow. Hey dude, are you aware of what this book is? And he's like, yeah, tell me again. And I'm like, well, Dinesh D'Souza is like a right wing lunatic. And he's like, okay. And so, all right. And I said, you realize, like, the only way I would talk about this book is, like, I would just slam it. And he goes, well, we might be able to get paid for the first one. You know, like, it was just like.
I actually like that.
Don't you have any, like, barometer other than whether or not, like, it's just. That type of stuff just.
He does not.
Just, I just. And the problem is that when you do that, folks, I'll tell you. And I wouldn't attribute every you know time you hear this about somebody, but that went, by the time that gets out to anybody else who works even peripherally, you know, like program directors, the marketing department, whatever it is, and then ultimately, if you're you know sort of prominent enough, it would get out to the public. And that, in my case, the guy's very difficult to work with. He's very difficult. This is very difficult. There's always a problem with that guy. And it's just like, I want to show some measure of respect for the people that we're talking to. You know, he's a problem. He's difficult to work with. He's difficult to work with. That's what it is. You know, and that's, there's no doubt in my mind. Like, you know, when Barry Crimmins did that with that producer, you know, from CNN, whoever it was, the Booker or whoever he had that conversation with, they walked away and said, you know, they don't say like, weird. Maybe I should contemplate like that idea of like how involved I am with a guy who really, it's almost uncontroversial that he's, you know, if not a war criminal, certainly a war, not so good guy. Instead, what they walk away with is like, wow, I was just blown away by how rude Barry Crimmins was. You know, like that's what comes out of that interaction. Not like, I mean, I just really contemplate the fact that I'm, you know, serving, I'm asking the war criminal if he has enough, you know, soda pop in the green room, as opposed to like, yeah, that Barry Crimmins, very difficult to deal with. I don't want to, makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't know.
Blair certainly gets, and he's not, I would in no way compare Blair, frankly, to the level of Kissinger. And I think he's a little bit more of a complicated figure, but an awful figure. And his treatment in the UK is, he has a very different experience than Kissinger.
Well, you saw
maybe
a little bit
not
of that
in media, but in media as well. He's relentlessly hounded people trying to make citizens' arrests of him, all sorts of things.
There's two things. One, you saw a little bit of that with General Petraeus in this country.
Right.
But I also think, frankly, there is still in, at least in the UK and probably in other parts of Europe, a sense of like, hey, there's a responsibility to the realm.
The
you know
Lord,
what I mean?
Right,
like, you know,
right.
It's like, there's a, like, there's, you know, you, the idea of, I think there was one ambassador or envoy we had who resigned during the Iraq invasion. But the idea of like resigning in protest in this country, we have such a rationale that is like built up around why people don't do that. Like I could resign, you know, but I wouldn't be able to affect it from the inside. And also I've got a mortgage. But I mean, it's, you know, there's, you see that, that sense of like, hey, there's like, you know, we got to maintain some decorum, you know, some
just
level
really, yeah,
of societal
large
responsibility.
Swaths of the population there, he is just unacceptable. And he was a prime minister. I mean, let alone some kind of like, you know, shadowy foreign policy guy. There's people who on the domestic side of his agenda, which wasn't great either, but there's people who were like, you know, we have a minimum wage because of him that we didn't have before. There's better, you know, performance at hospitals. I still think he's a war criminal who should go to jail because of Iraq. Yeah. And they just didn't skip over it. And if anything, they're trying to open up other things.
I mean, part of that is why it's so important in my mind. It was so important to try and prosecute Bush and Cheney and whatnot. Because if you just let that stuff lie out there, if you just let it like just become normalized in some way. I mean, I'm encouraged by the fact that people still, I think, you know, see Cheney as, you know, I don't like to use the word evil because it just seems this a little cartoonish, but as a really bad person.
He's unacceptable.
As an unacceptable figure. Unacceptable. And I'm encouraged by that. And I think that, like, you know, he's not one of those guys who, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens when Cheney dies in terms of the way that he is sort of, you know, lauded. Because Nixon, when he died, it was like, he was a great guy, except for all that other stuff. And, with Kissinger, I mean, it's just going to be.
Oh, that's going to be pure lily white coverage. But really, really quick question. I know you got to run. Do you think, and this is obviously completely speculative, but whatever, I'll just put it out there. Do you think on any level, even subconsciously, I know you think about the Kennedy assassination and things like that. When Obama comes into office, independent of his own politics and instincts, which are very centrist and establishment, you think on some level he thinks, I'm coming in here in the middle of a war, in the middle of a very empowered CIA and intelligence service. There's a lot of controversy around these issues. Do I really want, in addition to everything else, to like stir the hornet's nest of actually trying to hold anybody criminally culpable for this?
Well,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, but I don't know that it has to do with the CIA. I mean, to hold, I think
if you
they
included
basically
torture,
came in,
it would include them, right?
Right, like, but know. I mean, I think that you could make the argument that look, the buck stop with the with Bush and with Cheney, and I mean, you could say that, and
right.
You might have to go down the you know to Rumsfeld and others, and certainly you know at one point I moderated an impeachment hearing with. John Conyers, and he had a book literally this big, like size of, you know, very wide of like, you know, impeachable offenses that I imagine would be part of, you know, some type of indictment. Well, there's no doubt. I don't think it was a question of him saying like, I'm afraid to do this. I think it was like, I don't want to expend any energy on this. Like I have an agenda and I have my own legacy and I don't want to expend on this. And there's certainly, you know, it's very hard to imagine. Although I think actually it would have helped Obama considerably to have spent more time, frankly, demonizing Bush early on.
Absolutely.
Early on. I mean, demonizing, perhaps the wrong word, but attributing, you know, like making this laundry list and maybe not quashing other people from trying to raise this stuff. Because I think just strategically, I don't know that if I was Obama and I wanted to get my agenda done, that I would pursue it. But I don't know that it would have been a bad thing for me to have members of Congress pursue it. One, to set a more public narrative. Two, even as a bargaining chip, if I wanted, with the Republicans. Like, you have to, and this is, you know, This is part of like Kissinger's, you know, his sort of, I guess, strategy or ideology or philosophy or whatnot. The best defense is a good offense. I mean, that is, you know, there's something to that. You know, I just went through this thing with Myla at school where, but I'm not going to go into the details. It's not a great situation, but it involved other parents. And Myla was, saying a victim is a little bit too, but to the extent that this infraction occurred, Myla was, to the extent that she was involved, she knew the people who did the infraction. She was also a sort of a tangential victim of the infraction. In fact, probably the one who had the most, if we wanted to pursue it, we could have caused a lot of problems. But it involved another person who was also victimized in some way, not as sort of like actionable and maybe in some respects as Milo was. But we just wanted to lay low because we knew that that kid had had other problems. And we laid low. And by the time it worked through its system, Myla became perceived and accused as being one of the perpetrators. Because we didn't go in there at that one moment and stake out like a claim, like, hey, she's been victimized. It created a vacuum. And that vacuum was filled by these people looking for someone to blame. Ultimately, it all worked out. It was sorted out, although there's still some friction from that initial thing. But it, in a very microcosmic way, it just sort of said, like, you know, if you don't go in there and fill that vacuum, if there is an offense that is created and you don't go in there and fill that vacuum, something else will. And it will, you know, there's only basically, you know, in this situation, there's two teams. There's one that wants to say that they did nothing wrong, and there's one that wants to say that they did. And if, you know, that's why when people get that aggressive, like the Kissingerian, they look at football because it really is like a grid like that.
Right.
You're either on their 30-yard line or you're going to be on your 30-yard line. And that area, that 100 yards, are going to be filled one way or another.
Well, Obama clearly thinks more basketball in some ways, but where you could kind of like transcend the action as a great individual player.
Well, play that goes on in between that is irrelevant, right? Because you can get down to, I don't know.
No, but I mean, but I also just, that old line of like, you can't turn the page of history until it's been written. And I also think of the contrast too of how when Bush came to the office, they were like, yeah, they stole furniture and totally messed the place up. And Obama's like, yeah, they committed war crimes. But look, let's be respectful.
Right. When the Bush people to create that myth were like, the Clintons stole W from the keyboards or something. You know, like literally that was a whole big story. Like the Clintons stole like China. You know, and it was a smart move. Like, you know, let's just get them on there. But, all right. I got to go. We're going to take a break, go into the fun half. Michael will take it from here. I'll be back tomorrow on the program, joined by Cliff. I'm already late, and I got to deal with this. Okay, folks, you know the drill. See you tomorrow or in the fun half. Be right back.